grandma and still is, but in my view, she is his biggest victim. When he would lose his temper and I would call her for help, she would say things like, "Don't answer him back, you're going to make him worse," or, "Just make him a cup of tea and say you're sorry and he'll calm down." I don't believe anyone should be actively encouraged to put up with it, and I hated her for it. To get through my relationship, I blame the way Tony's mum had raised him for his behaviour. Of course, I can see now that is wrong. His actions are his alone, and she just acted on how she thought best. It was all she knew from her own relationships. As their grandma, I believe that she has the girl's best interests at heart. Life was no different for a while, really, until it was. On the 27th of December 2010, I left for the next sale at 5 a.m. I queued in the cold for what seemed like hours. It was absolutely heaving, and while I was fighting other shoppers in the crowd, I heard a text ping to my phone and vibrate. I ignored it and carried on shopping. When I walked back through the front door just before 8 o'clock in the morning, Tony was on the sofa with my three stepdaughters and Betsy, while Tallulah was still upstairs in her cot asleep. "Did you get my text?" he snapped. "No," I replied. He immediately lost his temper. Apparently, he had a headache, and he had texted me and asked me to go and buy him some paracetamol. I hadn't read the text, so I hadn't bought him his paracetamol, and that was all it took. Right there and then, something clicked inside me. I don't know if it was watching Betsy quickly run up the stairs so she wouldn't see what she knew was about to happen, or if it was my middle stepdaughter, who is now 10 years old, repeatedly jumping and punching her dad in the back while screaming about how much she hated him for what he was doing to me. I don't know if it was my baby stepdaughter, now 9 years old, crouched behind the sofa knowing what was coming. I don't know if I knew I had one sleeping baby upstairs who I was determined to make a change for. I don't know if it was all this put together, but something happened that day where I knew it was different to all the other times I had left. This time I knew it was for good. It went the same way as it always did. I said I was leaving and told the girls to get their shoes on. He said I wasn't going anywhere. He locked the front door and hid the keys while things began spiraling more and more. He told the girls to ignore me being silly and everything would calm down. I told him calmly to let us go or I would smash my way out of the house. He knew right then that I was done and he knew that he had gone way too far. He arranged for his ex-partner to collect the three older girls while I took Betsy and Tallulah to my mum's. This was something she was ordered to do regularly when an incident occurred and Tony wanted them taken away from the house. I arrived at my mum's at 8:30 in the morning. She saw the state of me and just cried. We had done this so many times. Me arriving with the kids in tow, her crying, begging me to leave and telling me she feared I would end up dead. I'd always remain silent unless I was reassuring the kids. She was so used to it. But this time I was adamant that it was over. Usually, Tony would arrive and when Mum didn't let him in, he would scream threats at her through her letterbox and her windows and I would feel such guilt and panic that I would just apologise to Mum and go home and face the music. This time though, Mum called John immediately. This was something we hadn't had to do since I had gone into refuge years earlier, and he arrived minutes later. I could see in his eyes that he was devastated, but I could also see he was tired of this routine. As calm as ever, he placed a wad of notes on Mum's coffee table. "There's 3 grand there," he said. "You can have it on the condition that you use it for a home for you and the girls, and you never, ever go back." It was a lifeline. My sister came and collected Betsy and Tallulah while I got cleaned up and made the decision to call the police. They arrived shortly after and began speaking to me. They do this interview where they have to ask you 28 questions in relation to domestic abuse. One of the officers was a guy from my old school and I was mortified. I had left that school and town under a black cloud and now, coming face to face with him years later, I looked like I was in a worse state than back then. He was so sweet to me and made such an effort to help me see the light. But I remember wanting to scream at him that I wasn't a scumbag. I had a good job, a company car, I was a decent person, a good mum, but instead I was just sat there in shame, utterly mortified at what he must have thought. I remember feeling so ashamed when I was asked the questions, which are really intrusive and embarrassing. Now that I help women in my situation, I understand the purpose that those questions serve and how important they are to build a case. But back then, I was just so disappointed in myself. It made everything much more real. My mum was sobbing whilst listening to me and I just wanted to curl up and die. It was the same self-hate I'd felt when I'd let Martin down. The police agreed that, due to the situation, they would return to my home and be present while I collected my belongings. I took my clothes, the girls' clothes, and a single mattress. I left behind everything else that I had spent years working my arse off for. The whole time I was packing my things, he sat on the sofa trying to tell anyone who would listen how sorry he was. I guess, in his head, he was. He always was, but sorry when you're in a relationship like that means nothing after a while. I was back to having my life in bin bags, six this time, and as I headed away, I knew that I was about to hit rock bottom in order to climb back up again. I now see this phase of my life as a turning point. It had just gotten so bad. I was worn down. It's the point at which I could take no more, and I started to feel that I deserved to be saved. Looking back on this, I would probably advise people to always follow their heart. If I'd have followed mine, I would never have gone back for seconds with my dad and our relationship. He broke my heart before any other man got the chance to, years before I should have experienced heartbreak from any man. And because I listened to someone else, I went back and endured it all again. Sometimes we walk into fire because we want what other people have, even though we know that we're not going to get it, when actually it's better just to keep walking the opposite way. Learn from others every day. It's something that I struggle to do. Look at the woman who's been beaten in the refuge and do anything and everything you can to stop yourself from turning into her. If you are her, learn from that too. Learn from the women who have moved on from that refuge and stayed away, the ones who did get their lives and their freedom back, and convince yourself you can be them. Things will work out. No matter how bad they seem, how much of a shit situation you have gotten yourself into, and how many toxic people you're surrounded by, you have to keep hope and you have to keep going through it all, because if you have an idea of how you want your life to look, if you have that dream, you just need to plan in baby steps day by day. Chapter 8. Starting Over. I moved into a flat which was an absolute shithole. There was no central heating, and it had previously belonged to an old lady who had suffered from incontinence before her family had taken her to a care home to be looked after. The smell was horrendous, and the decor was appalling. The bathroom was carpeted with cream shag pile, which I imagine had been laid about 30 years earlier. It was spectacular, really. I can't even begin to describe the colour and stench of it. I had nothing, apart from a single mattress, a blow-up bed, and two double quilts my mum had given me. That night, I saw New Year's Eve in with my daughters and my two youngest stepdaughters. We played Scrabble and ate Domino's pizza. We had a bedsheet up at the window and we all slept together on the mattresses on the lounge floor. I remember watching all four of them snooze around me. I didn't have a pot to piss in. I'd spent the last 24 hours cleaning used needles off the tops of my kitchen cupboards, which had been left there by the previous tenants, who, my neighbours had told me, had been evicted due to their heroin addiction. And I had no idea how I was going to make anything right for them ever again, but I knew that somehow this surely had to be the beginning of my new happiness. The next few months were horrific. It may well have been coincidental, but it was at that time that my mum was investigated for benefit fraud by the council, and my company car got keyed twice. Tony rang my sister several times with unfounded allegations about her husband. Again, the guilt sat heavy in me as people continued to suffer, I believed, because of my life choices, and while my family continued to support me, I knew that they had endured 10 years of this man in my life, which ultimately kept me stronger to prove to them that I wouldn't go back. As much as I knew I had made the right choice, I felt broken. As I explained earlier, my therapist says that because of abandonment issues in my childhood, I struggled to cope with being alone. And I am okay with admitting that now because I know that it's not my fault. I hope when I do struggle, it makes other women see that we are not weak because of it. I see some of my closest friends rock the shit out of being single mamas, and they're absolutely fine with being by themselves, whereas I hated it. I felt so alone. I hated not having a family unit. I hated not having someone to look after me, even though the reality was I had never really been looked after. I panicked every night and day that I would never meet anyone to love me or my babies again. Every other weekend the girls went to their dad, I would sit in the flat and cry, big fat sobs, which would lead into a panic attack. I would also cry when the girls were asleep at night and I was awake, alone. That was the word that seemed to just flow through everything, alone, My friends rallied round as much as they could, and while they were with me, I felt much better. But they had their own lives and families, and it just wasn't practical for them to be there all of the time. Over the following year, I went on a few shitty dates. I quite liked one guy. We saw each other for a couple of months, and I invited him along to a big barbecue I went to with some friends at a local pub. But the following week, it was my birthday, and he bought me a Super Nanny book, clearly letting me know that he thought my kids were arseholes, so that relationship ended up being short-lived. I then met up with somebody called Sam, who I had gone out with at school. We were a couple for about 6 months before I'd left Brixham when I was 15. Sam had also come out of a really difficult situation and was a bit lost, and I think he was as desperate as I was to settle down. Immediately, he wanted to take me and the girls on. He was a good, decent man. Sam worked away from Monday to Friday, but when he was at home, he spoiled us with love and gifts, and he was definitely good for us. But then a few months in, I had a moment of clarity where I knew it wasn't right, and when Sam came home on the Friday, I explained how I felt. He said he would give me space and left me alone, and I missed him, just not in a way where you're in love, but in a way where you miss a companion, a friend. He was my friend and I loved him, so after a day apart, I again convinced myself I would make things work. By now, I also knew that I absolutely hated being alone, and stupidly, I allowed it all to move way too quickly with him. Rather than having therapy, learning to love myself again, and seeing that I could actually cope on my own, I decided that a full-on hardcore relationship right now was just what I needed, so I jumped in. Pretty soon, I was pregnant. I convinced myself I was happy, really happy, and I couldn't wait to have a pregnancy where I would be looked after and safe. After a scan, I was informed that there was no heartbeat, and I had to wait 7 days, then to be scanned again in case the sonographer was incorrect and the baby was, in fact, healthy. 7 days later, I went back, but there was still no heartbeat. The happiness was over, just like that. It was so sudden, so devastating. My baby was surgically removed under a general anaesthetic the following week. I continued to try for another baby, blaming my unhappiness on the miscarriage, and a few months later I fell pregnant again. Things were going well, and then it was like deja vu. Another scan, no heartbeat, and another operation. I know that at this point I wasn't easy to live with. I was hormonal, desperate for a baby, and I believed that as soon as I had one, it would be the answer to everything. Looking back, I can see how ridiculous that was, but I'd lost 2 babies in such quick succession when I'd thought things were finally getting better. So it seems almost predictable that I would start to make connections that weren't there. I became pregnant again a few months later, but spent the whole 9 months in a state of panic as I thought I would lose the baby. I dreaded the visits to the midwife, where she would listen for a heartbeat. I didn't sleep for days leading up to the scans. Thankfully, everything seemed to be going well until 6 weeks before I was due, the midwife told me that the baby was breech. I began going in weekly to see if the baby had moved, but it hadn't. They then asked if I wanted an appointment where the doctor would turn the baby so I could avoid a cesarean section and try and have another vaginal birth. I agreed to do this, but went home and began researching on YouTube what actually happens. I worked out that the doctor actually manipulates the baby around your belly using lots of movements, almost forcing the baby into a non-breech position. It looked really uncomfortable, and I worried whether it would stress the baby. I arrived the following week for the appointment, and upon having a scan, I was told the umbilical cord was wrapped around the baby's neck and there was minimal fluid surrounding it. The doctor said he was happy to try and still move the baby. However, the risks were now higher and there was every chance it could flip back around immediately after being turned. I was beyond nervous, but I was also worried about having a cesarean section. It would mean Tallulah would be starting her induction days at primary school just after the birth, and I wouldn't be able to drive her there and back. So the shit mum guilt hit me. Starting school was a huge thing in her little life, and she would feel so left out. I couldn't do it, though. I couldn't go through with the attempts to shift the baby. As soon as he did one movement to give me an indication of what he would be doing, I almost hurled all over him with the pressure that I felt. So I packed up my stuff and I went home to wait for my invite letter for my first cesarean section. I arrived at the hospital on the 23rd of August 2013, at 8 o'clock in the morning, to be informed that I was last on the list. I waited for a while and a nurse came in to insert my cannula before I was finally taken into theatre just before midday. I have never gone into a theatre awake before and I felt like I'd died. Everything is so white that your eyes hurt, and it just reminded me of how it would be going to heaven, and I don't even know if I believe in heaven. I would describe a cesarean section as someone washing up in your belly. There was a lot of pulling and pushing, and I could see my shoulders juddering about from being moved, but there was no pain at all. It seemed like very shortly after it began, I was handed my 6-pound, 13-ounce baby girl who I'd named Edie, chosen again by my mum. Immediately, I needed to be sick. It was the same sick as a drunk sick on the way home in the back of a taxi, where you feel like the alcohol is poisoning your body and you need to get it out. I started retching, but I was lying flat on my back and I couldn't get it all out. I was totally numb, so unable to get myself up, and I started really panicking. I was trying to stick my fingers down my throat, but I had the machines attached to me and the nurses were holding my hands down. In the end, I vomited over myself and I began crying because I was panicking so much. My friend Hannah was quite a pro at having cesarean sections, and she told me I would be allowed home the day after giving birth as long as I passed enough fluid. So I drank and drank and drank. I went to the extremes of drinking, as if I'd been in the Sahara Desert for 3 days without any liquid. The following day, the nurses followed me to the toilet to take a wee in a cardboard piss pot, and I couldn't stop. I had lost all ability to stop pissing, and it just kept coming and coming. It even went over the side of the bowl. I was trying to shuffle back towards the toilet, but the pain was horrific, so I just continued to wee all over the toilet floor. It was like a river, and I was absolutely mortified. It worked, though, because straight afterwards they got me changed, packed my bag full of painkillers, and sent me home. The pain of the cesarean section was like nothing I'd ever known before, and getting up with the baby in the night is such hard work, because when you wake to their cries, you forget what you've just endured, and you go to sit up, but it knocks you back. You forget that when you pull your body to sit up, you use all your tummy muscles that have been cut open. When you cough, sneeze, or move slightly, it wrecks. You have a day where the pain seems less, so you do more. Maybe take the baby for a quick stroll, or run the vacuum round, but then you pay for it the next day when you can't move at all. I remember the surgeon explaining to me that because it was such a common procedure, people forget that it's actually a really big operation. She tried to show me how your tummy muscles knit back together really intricately, and then they're sliced through. For it to repair, it takes time, and for that to happen, you have to rest, but that's easier said than done when you're a mum with a newborn and other kids to add to the equation. I remember finding the recovery so much harder than I'd had with my first two babies. If I was to have another and I got the choice, I would choose popping them out of my Fandango any day. I was postnatally depressed again, but at the time I was adamant that I wasn't. By now I had a huge, beautiful home, lots of friends visited me, I was financially stable, my boyfriend wasn't a bastard, so I couldn't work out why I cried in secret every day. I would sob in the shower, knowing that no one would hear me, and all of those feelings of being desperate, lonely, and unhappy came flooding back. In the end, I cried in front of Sam, often, and he was helpless. He was helpless because he didn't understand either, and I suppose that just created a bigger distance between us. Sam was, by now, working away all of the time. His bosses had no interest in family life, and would expect him to stay away over weekends as well by now, going as far as the Isle of Wight or Holland at a moment's notice. When he returned, I would cause arguments because I suppose I felt he was still carefree, and he didn't understand how hard things were for me running this tiny female army while he could come and go as he pleased. Actually, I imagine that all he wanted was to be at home with us. By the time Edie was 4 months old, I decided I couldn't be with Sam anymore. I knew, through the deepest bouts of depression, that this wasn't meant to be. I knew he deserved someone who loved him more than I did, who wanted all the things I couldn't make myself feel. When Sam came home, I told him I loved him, but I wasn't in love with him. I offered for him to live with us, as I didn't have the right to take the 3 girls from him, and he was a brilliant dad and stepdad, but I didn't want our relationship. I just felt that I couldn't do it. He did not want to stay under those conditions, so he packed his things and he went to his friends in Blackpool before moving out completely a few days later. For me, right now, today, after living through the pain of having my heart broken and breaking someone else's heart, if I had the choice, I would choose to have my heart broken all day long. I don't think you ever get over the guilt and devastation that comes with ripping someone's heart out because of your own choices. It sits with you always, years down the line, even after they heal and move on. When you have your heart broken, you do eventually get over it, and despite at the time it being the worst lesson to learn, it's just that, a lesson learned. Things became pretty horrific after I made the choice to end that relationship. I lived in a small town where I was now widely hated by a whole raft of people for upsetting one of the most popular, well-liked blokes in it. Facebook has a lot to answer for in my life. It led me back to Joshua around this time. Remember him? Hannah's gorgeous older brother. I was at my very worst, and we had been speaking on Facebook for a few months. He had the same sense of humour, which is what I love about his sister. He made me feel like me again, before I had the girls, before I started making shitty, life-changing mistakes. Josh had two sons who he idolised, and he was a police officer in our town. I started falling for him hard, and I panicked. I can only describe it as the same feelings I had when I used to dream about marrying Mark Owen when I looked at my Take That posters plastered all over my room when I was about 12 years old. That kind of teenage girl crush where you dream about marrying someone you will never meet. I started thinking about Josh as soon as I woke up. I was checking his profile a million times a day and, in general, just freaking myself out by being a weird stalker. I was also breastfeeding a tiny baby and I had two other daughters who I needed to focus on. I needed to sort myself out about going back to work so I could pay the bills on the huge house I could no longer afford the rent on, pay the finance on the car I could no longer afford to drive, and pay everything else that I had now full responsibility for. But if I'm totally honest, I didn't think for one minute Josh would be interested in someone like me, and I knew I was messing my own head up more than anything. I decided that I was being a total weirdo, so to sort my life out, I decided to block Josh on Facebook. A few hours later, he messaged me on Instagram asking why I'd blocked him. I felt sick that he'd even noticed, let alone think of what to answer. I decided to stick with what my big brother had always told me, that honesty was the best policy, and roll with the truth. I wrote back the most rambling, ridiculous, shit-filled message about how my body thought it was in love with him, but it wasn't. I just had crazy hormones buzzing about from having a baby. I told him I was overtired and perhaps had a touch of postnatal depression. Therefore, I was going to book myself a doctor's appointment so he could make my brain better, perhaps with some medication. Then, once it was and I stopped feeling like I was in love with him, I would unblock him again on social media and be normal again. He replied immediately. "Meet me now," it said. I had only ever left Edie once for a few hours by this point, and I knew that my mum would wonder where I was going if I said that I was going out. I told her that I was nipping to the doctor's for 5 minutes to grab her prescription, and as Edie had only just gone down, I would leave her to sleep. I went out the door stinking of stale milk. I hadn't washed my hair for 3 days, and I probably could have knitted my armpit hair. I had no idea what I was thinking as I got into my car and started driving towards him, but I knew I was an absolute mess. I certainly expected Josh to be really confident when I saw him, whereas I, on the other hand, was by now a nervous wreck. I met him at the top of the crossroads close by, and as I pulled up, I remember wondering if we were going to get out and go for a walk, or if I should get in his car, or if he was going to get out and get into mine. Then I looked round my car and it resembled a mobile skip. I was mortified, so quickly jumped out and got into his. He was visibly shaking. His hands were all jittery and he had a bottle of water he kept sipping from nervously. I can picture every detail of that day. His car had one of those tree air fresheners hanging on the mirror called Black Ice. That smell today would bring back all of those feelings, I imagine. It's funny how smells have the power to do that. I remember his car was immaculate. I remember thinking that I was pleased I'd made the choice to go into his, because if he'd have seen the state of mine, he would have got straight back out and driven off. He looked so nervous, frightened almost. He kept flipping the lid on his bottle of water, and it was beyond awkward. We both giggled nervously. "Do you want to go for a walk?" he asked. I said yes, and we got out of the car. Within seconds it started to hail. Josh grabbed my hand and we ran to a sort of wooden bunker, wet through. We stood under the bunker to shelter from the rain and I could see that his hands were still really shaking. Then he turned round and held my face with both of his hands and kissed me. I'd like to say how romantic it was, but it really wasn't. I looked like utter shit and he was a shaking, silent mess. I had no idea whether he was going to go in for a peck or a snog, and I thought I was going to hurl with the nerves I had, so it was all a bit of a fuck-up, to be honest. I didn't understand what was going on, so I started rambling on that I was crazy. I kept telling him that I had 3 kids by 2 men and repeatedly pointed out everything that would put him off, because I was in shock that he was saying all this stuff to me, and it was clear he wasn't aware of what a liability I was. He kissed me again. "I'm in love with you," he said. "I'll wait for you. I understand that things are really tough and that Edie is tiny and that everything is really shit and raw, but I'll wait for you because I love you." He was adamant that he didn't want to pressure me into anything more than what we had, but he would wait years if he had to. He didn't want to have sex. He didn't want to see me in person if it made things difficult. He was happy to just keep chatting and messaging for as long as I needed. Fuck, I thought, what's happening now? I suppose, reflecting upon this part of my life, I almost feel grateful that things got so bad, because it showed me when they were getting better, and they did. Each week I made improvements, no matter how small, and I felt happier. Being a single parent is the hardest job in the world. When you're doing it while not in a good place, I would advise you to keep busy, especially on a Sunday. For some reason, it felt like my loneliest day, so try to be with your family and friends. It's better to be silent or sobbing with somebody holding your hand. It's crazy how your body changes with each new delivery to get the baby out of your body. My first birth was the most hideous labour, where I became extremely poorly afterwards, and my second one was so short that she was born in a lift with very little pain relief, and I was home the following day with no complications. But the caesarean section with Edie was a different experience again. No pregnancy or birth is the same. So if you have had a horrendous experience, don't let it put you off trying again, because all of mine was so different. Breakups are the most horrific things to endure when you have children. The heartache, devastation and guilt that take over are unbelievable, and there are periods where you think it will never end or get easier, but it does. It's all just time, and it passes much more quickly than you might imagine when you're in the middle of the shit. Chapter 9. Us against the world. Over the next few months, life was beyond vile. It didn't seem to have calmed down at all. Sam had moved on to new relationships with other people, while I met Josh for coffee out of town occasionally. But he was also going through a tough time with his ex-wife and trying to prioritise his sons, so we just messaged and spoke lots without seeing each other much. A few months later, it was my birthday. Sam was having Edie overnight for the first time since we'd separated, and Josh took me away to Cheltenham for the night. We talked a lot on the way up there, and I decided that I didn't want to keep us a secret anymore. I had never had any time away from Edie, and only a few nights a month without Betsy and Lula when they were with their paternal family. So, given that Josh's job was really demanding, seeing each other alone was proven to be difficult. While away, we agreed to start doing things together with our kids as friends, and they started getting to know each other. Unfortunately, the town we lived in was extremely small, and within a few hours of us being in Cheltenham, I had received hate messages about being away with Josh. We returned the following day, and from then on, we were about to experience hell like I'd never known. Within 10 days of people finding out about our relationship, Josh was arrested by his own colleagues under horrendous allegations. Although these proved to be false, he spent 8 hours sat in a police cell, and over the month, he was subjected to both internal and external investigations and removed from public-facing duties. At that time, Josh was due to be awarded a bravery medal for rescuing a woman from a house during an extremely dangerous domestic violence situation. Her perpetrator was given a lengthy custodial sentence for this incident, but he was informed that the award would be put on hold pending the outcome of the investigations. I received calls from Children's Services, who had received allegations that I was abusing my children, and my employer received calls saying I was stealing money from them. I can't prove if anyone was behind these events, or who it could be, but Josh and I were now being attacked in the most cowardly ways by a whole town of people, me to my face and him all over social media. Public statuses were written about us, and pictures of us and my children were put up. People that we had never met would comment that I should have my womb removed so that I couldn't have any more children. Someone said that Josh should be paid a visit in a dark alley, and we were told that we should both have our children taken away. It was truly the dark side of social media, More surprisingly, people we did know and people who were supposed to be our friends were also responding to these comments, liking them and sharing them, which meant that this toxic venom spread far and wide. It was us against the whole town, it seemed. Edie's father and I ended up in family court twice during the first 2 years of Edie's little life. During that time, my ex-partner and father of my youngest daughter, Sam, and Josh's ex-wife and the mother to his sons decided to embark on a relationship. Sam became the stepfather of Josh's sons and he moved in with them. You couldn't make it up. All of the children were bewildered and confused. My older girls couldn't understand why their once amazing stepdad, who had loved them so much, was now living with my new partner's ex-partner. It was beyond belief and left us all in shock. Josh and I were about to embark on 2 years of utter hell. Before Sam and I were due in court, I agreed to give him some supervised access to Edie. He had, by now, ended his relationship with Josh's ex and seemed to be really trying to make an effort in Edie's life. I'd had a really long telephone conversation with Sam from my work phone where he was so upset, and I broke for the situation he was now in. With Christmas around the corner, I wanted him to spend some time with Edie in the hope that things would become better for us all. One of my closest friends, Karen, agreed to supervise the access on Christmas Eve for 5 hours at her house. Edie loved Karen and was used to spending time with her children, as they would sleep at our house most weekends, and Betsy would sleep at theirs a lot of the time too. We saw each other most days. When Karen dropped Edie home, she said it had gone well and she kept going on about what an amazing daddy was. I found that quite strange, given that she'd seen me go through hell. Still, it was positive, Edie was happy, and it was progress. The following day, Christmas Day, was also Karen's birthday. I called her first thing to wish her happy birthday and to see if she was okay. I had taken her kids out the day before to buy presents for her from them. She answered the phone, and almost immediately, she told me she'd spent the night with Sam. I remember I didn't say much. I think I was in shock. When I put the phone down, I told Josh, and he was really angry. Karen and Josh had grown up together, and he loved her mum and dad to bits. Josh doesn't argue with people. He isn't nasty, and he doesn't entertain any kind of conflict. He says it how it is, calmly and rationally, and that's that. He doesn't scream and shout. He just makes his point, and he's always fair. What he was hurt about is because of what we had endured together, we had cut ourselves off from most people. We had almost become recluses, and we didn't have many friends at that point, because the drama that surrounded us was so humiliating that we were embarrassed. We'd also stopped trusting people because we'd been let down time and time again. The only person we really spoke to about the whole situation was Karen, Josh as well as me, and she was understanding of that. She didn't judge us, she supported us. And I think Josh was genuinely hurt because he considered Karen to be one of our very best friends and all five of our children loved her. At that time, Karen had a mouth infection and she hated dentists, so I'd arranged to take her for her appointment a few days later. She stopped calling me after the bombshell about spending the night with Sam, so I decided to drive to her house and sort things out with her. When I pulled up, Sam's car was on the drive, and the next day and the day after that, it was clear that they were now living together. By this time, I had run out of people to supervise contact between Sam and Edie, so I agreed to do it myself. We went to a soft play area every other Saturday for 3 hours. After a few weeks, I was to leave him and Edie alone for a few hours. I was then in charge of allowing more access as and when it was appropriate. Edie loved Sam immediately, and it was clear to me that he idolized her. They look so alike, and they have the same features. Their hands, their feet, the same face when they're tired, and they both sleep deeply with their mouths open. When I saw them together, it broke me that she'd missed out on so much time with her daddy due to the shit that goes on between adults. Over time, Edie's contact with her dad became more regular, and she now stays at his house every Wednesday plus every other Saturday, and if he wants extra time with her, that's also fine. Sam is still with Karen and they're really happy. I'm not ever going to be the person that says, she was never my friend to do that to me, because I believe she was my friend. She was a really good friend, one who loved me, looked out for me, and wanted the best for me. She was like an aunt to mine and Josh's children, and she supported me when things were bad. So when this happened, I was heartbroken. I won't be the person that says I didn't care, because actually, I did care. Her choice hasn't made me love or question any of my other friends any less. I still love them all as much and as hard as I can. Karen was my friend, one of my very best, but I felt upset and disappointed by our choice of partner. She is an amazing stepmom to Edie, so it doesn't hurt me anymore. Sometimes, I'll find an old picture of us, or a card, or a memory, and it makes me question how it ever came to this. But ultimately, we're all okay and happy. If a lost friendship had to happen to lead to this, then so be it. Now, we all get on. Edie is the happiest, most secure little girl because she is loved by both sets of parents and step-parents. She doesn't hear negativity and she is allowed to love. She sees her daddy come into our house and chat, and she sees Karen and I getting on when I drop her to their house. Edie is allowed to tell me that she has a second mummy, and she is allowed to call Josh her daddy too because that's what she wants. That's what makes her happy, so that's what we do. After years of turmoil, I'm finally at peace with how things have turned out. I just wish we could all get on with our exes like this, but life, and the page, has taught me that that just isn't the case very often. While I was fighting Sam, Josh was also fighting his ex-partner over their two boys. His eldest son was 8 years old at the time, and he would tell Josh all sorts of worrying things about the situation at home. He then stopped talking altogether. Both boys totally changed, we felt, and became really withdrawn. No matter how many times Josh voiced his concerns to professionals, it seemed nothing could change. The school said it needed permission from the courts to allow them to step in, and the courts did not respond to Josh's emails. So it continued and continued. It was utterly draining and heartbreaking. Josh didn't sleep a full night throughout those 2 years. I would wake to find him sobbing downstairs. He was convinced that something bad would happen to the boys. We naively borrowed tens of thousands of pounds to pay for solicitors and barristers to represent us. And other than going to work, neither of us left the house without each other. There were nights, whole nights, when we just wouldn't sleep. We were so unwell with anxiety that we couldn't eat, we lost so much weight, and every day we faced a new public status or challenge online. It was so stressful. It was relentless. I know that we're not the only ones it happens to, and that making a patchwork family is one of the hardest things in the world, but there were times when I just couldn't see any light at the end of the tunnel, and I wondered how we would ever get through it. There were days where Josh and I couldn't bear to be apart from one another. There were days where we just couldn't bring ourselves to open the post in case it was more bad news, or answer another call from a withheld number, because we knew it would be something else that would devastate us. But the reality is you have to. You have to keep going and hoping that it will get better. A friend sent me this, and I think it's beautiful, so now seems like a good time to put it in. Just to remind anyone out there going through this sort of shit, just what it is that you're fighting for. So, what is a patchwork family? Families thrown together in the aftermath of a distressing or harmful breakup, perhaps. Families brought together after years of compromising and understanding. That's us. I find myself in a very unusual but extremely satisfying situation, where two families have been brought together as one. My family consists of me, my wife Sarah, my son Jackson, who is nearly 13, and our son Alfie, who is 7. When Alfie was 2, his mum Sarah and I made the difficult decision to live our lives separately. She was young and had dreams of university and certainly wasn't ready for the reality of family life. It was hard, very hard. I missed my boy more than I ever thought was possible, but I knew I had done the right thing. I was brought up in a home with arguments and sometimes violence, and although it would never have got to that, the tension between us when we were together was unbearable and there was no way I was going to let my son be a part of that. Life was tough. Every decision I made regarding Alfie was met with controversy. Having to liaise with someone when you have so much resentment clouded every judgment I had to make. Before long, there was another man in Sarah's life. Another father figure spending the time with my son that I should have been. Resentment turned to anger. I found it so hard to control my emotions. Every time I used to drop him home, I would fight back to hold the tears, quite unsuccessfully most of the time. Not long after, I met Sarah number 2. This woman was perfect. She adored me and adored Alfie. I had found someone who would do anything for either of us. We were a family. As years passed, things got better. Initially, I was very unfair to Sarah's partner. He was caught up in a situation through no fault of his own, and he had been nothing but polite and courteous to me. In fact, over time, I had come to realize that this guy who I had resented so much at the start was actually the best father figure I could have ever wished for Alfie. Also, with the relationship between me and Sarah, he was often the voice of reason at times of adversity and conflict. He was the glue that pulled our once damaged relationship back together for the sake of our son. So often, people have been amazed at the relationship that has developed between our families. Much praise has been given to Sarah and me for the harmonious lives that we live, but we are not the ones that should be praised. Sarah's partner has been understanding and trusting. He has let me be the dad and never stood in my way. Without that, our lives would have never been where they are now. However, the person who deserves more praise than anyone is my new partner. She has been so understanding from day one. I mean, how many girlfriends would support you and understand whenever you wanted to go around your ex's house, or even stay over on Christmas Eve to be able to wake up and see your little boy's face in the morning? I don't think I'll ever understand how hard it must have been for her, but she stood by me in every decision I had to make for the good of my child. And now we have a boy together. Another son. I couldn't be happier. A brother to Alfie who, despite initially thinking my partner was going to give birth to a dinosaur, was over the moon with his new sibling. Life has settled down nicely for us all. The birth of James was shortly followed by the marriage of Sarah and her partner, and soon they had a little girl, Chloe. I feel this was the time that brought us all together. Chloe was diagnosed with a very rare type of cancer when she was only a few months old, and it devastated us all. I would have done anything to make it better for them, but I felt helpless. They were going through so much pain. But, by some divine miracle, she pulled through and has turned into a beautiful, funny little girl who is like the daughter I've never had. Chloe regularly stays with us and her brothers, as James does at their house. I sometimes find myself looking at my family, my partner on her phone, the boys bickering because Alfie has just thrown James into a fiery furnace on Minecraft, and Chloe snuggled up to me on the sofa talking absolute rubbish. And I think how lucky I am to have such a beautiful family and how things have turned out. Last year, we got married, my boys at my side. Chloe is our beautiful flower girl, and Sarah and her husband as our witnesses. Ridiculous, some might think, but I believe that it's amazing. Sarah is due to have another little boy now, and we can't wait to welcome him into our family. Every one of us has played a part. Compromises, understanding, sacrifices, trust and love. What is a patchwork family? I'd like to think, if you looked it up, there would be a picture of us, and I couldn't be happier. The stress, the heartache, and the complications of being a patchwork family can sometimes feel overwhelming. But you can make it work and you will get there. Here are a few tips I would give to anyone battling it out. Family court is something I am asked about daily. It's a daunting process, and while Women's Aid works tirelessly to change how the courts do things, there are still huge improvements that need to be made. Some judges save worlds, while others seem to make choices that devastate childhoods. What I will say is that you can self-represent. It is daunting, but I couldn't afford a solicitor, so I did represent myself, and I was okay. The court process is explained by CAFCAS, and you will get through it. Please, don't panic about it at all. There is nowhere near enough awareness of it, and because of that, it frightens people. It's not forever. As difficult as it is to fight with an ex-partner and to feel beyond hurt at their actions and choices, it isn't forever. It feels like it is. It feels like you will always be drowning in misery, and everyone you thought you could trust can't be trusted. But actually, it's not that bad. Time heals, and with healing you do forget, forgive, and move on, I promise. If your new partner has children, then watch what type of parent they are. Personally, I would rather be irritated by a guy who wanted to bring his kids along to everything we did, rather than not see them. Children need good role models. They need parents whose love will help them thrive, and I believe that how a person treats their child from a previous relationship says a huge amount about them. Chapter 10. Becoming a Family. When something happens now that reminds us of that time and we talk about it, we sometimes laugh. Sometimes I still cry. A lot of the time, Josh will give my leg a squeeze and my forehead a kiss. And I know it's his way of saying, we made it. And really, both of us have no idea how we did. Day and night for 2 years, we fought a town full of people who held such venom and poison for us, and it was relentless. It affected our families, and at times I used to think it would end up being the death of Josh's mum. What I also remember from that time is how many people let us and our children down. People who we thought would have been there for us weren't, and that taught me a huge lesson. Never take opinion or get involved in situations you don't know enough about, because the effects can be truly damaging. Josh's workforce should have protected him and looked after him, but they didn't. The police, the people you think are there to protect you, actually did everything but protect him, or that's how we saw it. All these people who could have helped make a shitty situation a bit better just made it worse, and it made me question the world and how people behave and act. I was determined that one day I would help to change it. We arrived at the final court hearing in July 2015, and Josh was awarded full custody of both boys, and their mum was given supervised access in a contact centre, but things didn't get better as we had hoped. Some days I hated her. Some days I could have physically hurt her when I thought of what the boys had been through, but mostly I just wanted her to get some help, which we felt she needed. When I listened to her last voicemail, I could hear how desperate she was. It broke me that she had two beautiful boys and an ex-partner who just wanted her to be okay, but it seemed she just felt so bad. She did not have enough support, in my opinion, and it was a hideous, sad situation, one I couldn't see getting any better. We went back to court and it was decided the boys would live with Josh until they were 18. The process was slow, but I genuinely think the respite allowed the boys' mum to see things for what they were. Right now, Sebastian understands more than Isaac, because unfortunately, he witnessed more and he was of an age to understand it. This week, the realisation has hit that Isaac is perhaps coming to an age where we need to be honest, but actually we don't know what's more damaging. So Josh is engaged with a registered charity and asked for help to understand the best way to protect his 8-year-old son going forward, until hopefully his mum can play a part in caring for him again. I get asked the question about our ex-partners so often by email and in my live shows. It's something you guys are extra inquisitive about, and I understand it because I'm the same with people. Things are better now with Edie's dad and the boy's mum, but it took a long time getting there, and I won't lie. There are days when something comes into my head that they did, or I come across a Kafka's report or a court order, and those feelings re-emerge, but only for a short while, because I look at where we are now and how happy and settled our children are. I want that to remain, so I take some deep breaths. I do remember the shit times, but I realise how lucky we are to no longer be there, to have overcome it all, because some people never find that peace. Unfortunately, it's not the same with Betsy and Tallulah's dad, Tony, which is a shame considering we nearly split up almost a decade ago. You can't get on with everyone. There are some people in life who are just too hard to work alongside, and for me, he's one of them. I have come to the realisation that will probably never change. Every time I've tried to get along with him, it has backfired, and it drained me so much that a few years ago, Josh took on the role of dealing with him. Josh manages the most horrid, awkward people in his job. He doesn't react to anything, he doesn't get wound up, and he never goes back for anyone who is trying to aggravate him. But shortly after he began contact with Tony to try and arrange his visits with the girls, he just felt that even he couldn't manage him. He was always drained after dealing with Tony, so we decided to no longer speak to him. He is blocked on both of our phones so we don't receive the messages. He calls to speak to Tallulah from a withheld number whenever he wants to. And it's hard, because occasionally we get a glimmer of a good dad. There will be no issues for months, and you start to think that things are improving, and then something happens, something as trivial as sending Tallulah without a jumper or the right shoes, and we go back to square one. At the time of writing this, I have just been shown a public Facebook status that someone who isn't involved has written about me, saying what an evil person and a bad mother I am, all of which seems pointless trying to fight. It takes a lot of effort to not respond, but it's the best way. Josh has a guy that he goes birding with who once said to me, "You can't educate pork," and that saying has stuck with me ever since because it's true, you really can't. Betsy's relationship with her dad is drastically different to Tallulah's. She isn't frightened of him when he loses his temper. She also has something inside her which I see inside me, the need to protect the people she loves, and it burns in her fiercely despite her being so young. Tony's downfall, it seems to me, is that he's learned nothing. I am told that he continues to speak badly of me to Betsy and Tallulah, whereas I would never do that about him because of what I experienced in my own childhood. I will also not allow Betsy to speak about him negatively to Tallulah, so if she starts, I ask her to go to her room where I follow and I let her have a private rant to myself or Josh, away from little ears that look up to their big sister and want to be just like her. Betsy knows what her dad says is wrong. She idolizes me as her mother. She has taken on that protector role with me no matter how many times I tell her it isn't how it should be. So over time, he has just driven her further away. She is also now of an age where she has the independence and knowledge to walk out of his house and get on a bus and tell me when he has started shouting, meaning that in the past year she has totally stopped seeing him. There is still a part of me that always hopes he will miss her so much that he will change for good, but right now, he seems to be still very much the same person that he was when we were together. She is at an age where things are tough for her, but he doesn't seem to see that. He doesn't see that. Right now, she doesn't know if she's coming or going. Her body is changing. She is a grown-up in a child's body. She needs people around her who understand all of that in order to parent her properly, and he doesn't seem to get it at all. And I imagine he won't when it comes to Tallulah. Right now, with Tallulah, I just monitor how she is. At the moment, she's easy. She's laid back and well-behaved, so the 6 nights a month she sees him, he manages. And while she's happy and it's going well, I would never step in. It isn't my job to stop him being a father when he is a positive influence. If he wanted more involvement, I would encourage that. However, he knows the minute he upsets Tallulah, I will be there, and I will protect her because it's a role, as a child, no one took on for me, so I am super aware as a mum and a stepmum that we have to do it for our own children. Right now, Tony and I have managed contact without the use of family court. He has access to Tallulah every other weekend, and on the Sunday in between she stays with his mum, and it works well. There are times she doesn't want to go, but mainly because she feels she's missing out on something I'm doing with the boys or Betsy, as they're always at home. But overall, she enjoys going, so there has been no need to have a court order in place. Family court is a daunting place. You see and hear things in the waiting room that make you question the world around you, and nothing was ever explained properly. Looking back now, Josh could have self-represented throughout his hearings. He is capable and he could have done it easily because he's used to giving evidence in trials and court hearings through his job. But you are drawn into believing that you need legal representation and you end up in tens of thousands of pounds of unnecessary debt. It's unfair and unjust for some people. Until recently, people that were subjected to domestic violence were allowed to be cross-examined by their ex-partner, their perpetrator, if they were not represented by a legal team. I found that appalling. That you leave the person who has subjected you to such horrors, then they're allowed to stand up in front of a court and ask you intimate questions and make accusations about your answers when you have lived in fear of them for years. It is something that Women's Aid fought so hard to get removed from the family court system, and they finally won. When I heard that news, it made me so happy to be able to pass it on to so many of my warriors. The family court system is better than it was, but it still needs improvement. Families continue to be let down too often, and ultimately, the decisions it makes affect children's lives for years. After 2 years of hell, we finally became a family of seven, the family we are today, but it was hard. We had fought for so long. The family court, the social workers, CAFCAS officers, the school, family, strangers, friends, solicitors and barristers. We had to ignore the lies all over Facebook and we were unable to defend ourselves. We lived in fear that Josh would be arrested again. We were unable to talk about any of it when the kids were around, through worrying that we would be accused in court of not protecting them from overhearing adult conversation, so we did stuff by text, email or hushed tones when they were asleep. We got used to being verbally abused when out in public while doing school runs with the kids or in a supermarket. And now it was all over. We were now managing the boys ourselves. There were no more hearings, no more CAFCAS reports, solicitors' letters, and it was strange. It was hard to adapt to a life where we were no longer sat under a microscope and we didn't have the constant battle that we've been used to fighting for so many years, against everyone and everything. I still haven't got much of a life back for myself, which will seem extraordinary considering I run a page that has built a community of almost 500,000 people. Chapter 11. A home full of love and chaos. It's hard to explain. but my life seemed to go from one shitstorm to another for so long that it's had a lasting effect on the way I live now. I have an amazing army of girlfriends who have been with me throughout the whole process, but I don't ever go out to socialise with any of them. They come to my house. I feel calmer at home. It still feels odd to think that we could go out if we wanted to. Since Josh and I have been together, I have never been on an evening out without him, and I have only been for lunch once with my best friend Leanne and once with his sister Hannah. I have never stayed away from home without Josh. I don't go out of the county without him because my anxiety overrides it. In order for me to write this book, I have needed to attend meetings with publishers and agents in central London and Edinburgh, and Josh has come with me everywhere. It's just something that I can't do on my own. I think because for so long things were so bad that I just didn't feel safe without him, and it's now a feeling that I'm used to. It's also what I'm comfortable with. I am open and honest about that, and my friends get it. They know I won't do girly weekends away or nights out. I've missed countless birthday meals and hen parties, but they understand my reasons, and so they no longer invite me along because it's just not me. They do know that my home is theirs, though, and when they come here, we eat nice food and drink wine, and they know that my door is always open. They also all love Josh. I suppose being raised around four sisters and his mum, he is used to chaotic women, so he gets it, and a lot of the time, my friends will sit and talk to him rather than me, about their shit relationships, their work, or issues with their kids, and he will chat for hours. Maybe in the future things will change, but for now, I only suppose I feel safe in my house with my babies and Josh. Other than him being a bird nerd when he goes to the moors or away with his friends to find rare eggs and nest, he also doesn't have much of a life without me. He could. I would never ever stop him or make an issue of it. In fact, sometimes I tell him to go and meet his friends for a drink or dinner, but he refuses. I think it's just the way we've become because of the horrendous start to things. It works for us, so we don't even really think about it anymore. Josh gets it. He understands why I am the way I am, and I think deep down he loves me for it. It's just normality for us now that we're two peas in a pod and everyone around us accepts it. Before becoming a part of my world, Josh and both his boys had led a really quiet life. The boys had never had friends round for a sleepover. Josh and his family tell me that his home was almost silent. Many of my friends are like this. They can't be doing with other people's kids and craziness. But I'm the total opposite. I don't do silent or quiet. I hate it. Recently, during a therapy session, my therapist asked if I could spend half an hour an evening when all the kids were in bed, with the TV off, in silence, processing my own thoughts and feelings, and my first answer was that I was too busy. But actually, when we broke it down, it became so clear that I can't. I don't want to stop running and slow down because then I have to think, as I have had to do to write this book. At times in life, thinking hurts. Slowing down to the point where the only thing you can hear is your own brain and the thoughts inside it can be utterly heartbreaking. I hope that by talking about my life so openly, people might pick up on what might help their situation. Josh's boys had believed for so long that their dad loved my girls more. There was a lot of jealousy to begin with, and in some form, this can happen with any blended family. We sat all five children down and explained that it didn't matter who came from who, they were all the same, loved the same and treated equally, and we were a family that was now together 24/7 and a patchwork family that was going to be absolutely fine. Due to Josh's shifts, I had to do the school runs each day from very early on, and that had its challenges too. Edie was at nursery and the boys went to school in a different town to Betsy and Tallulah, but had the same start time, so I had to do three drop-offs and then get to work by 9 o'clock while trying to remain calm. I worried about everything, to be honest, even normal everyday stuff. I had been under the spotlight for so long from every authority and professional that I got myself in a state about disciplining the boys. I was overthinking everything. Seb had been through masses and some mornings with him were absolute hell. He was so angry at times and he was desperate to test me. My therapist explained he would do this to make sure he was safe with me and that I wasn't going to let him down. But he got me to a point that no other child has ever got me to, where I would cry with anger when I was alone. At times, Seb didn't stop until he got a reaction where I showed that I was angry or upset. And while he went out of his way to get this reaction, life was at times unbearable for the other four kids. When he first came to us, nights were horrific. I couldn't settle him for hours, and he would wake constantly through the night. If Josh was working nights, Seb would sniff my drinks when I wasn't looking to check that I wasn't drinking alcohol. To this day, Josh and I don't drink alcohol together if we are with Sebastian, because he goes into a total panic that we will both get into.